Good morning and welcome to Morning Signal. I'm Endu.
And I'm Ava. It is Monday, April 7th, 2026, and Andrew, I have to say, I opened my phone this morning and just sort of stared at it for a second.
Same. It's a lot out there right now. Markets, the Middle East, AI, eating everything. We've got a full table today.
Full table is an understatement. Let's get into it.
Let's start with markets because, look, there's been some chatter this week that maybe, just maybe, the worst is behind us. Over on the compound and friends, Josh Brown and the crew were doing something interesting. They were actually putting probability estimates on whether Monday marked the bottom. They came in at 59 to 69% odds that we've seen the low. And they cited Ed Yardini, who came out and publicly called it.
That's a bold call given everything happening in the Gulf right now.
Right, and that's the thing. VIX is still sitting at 25 to 26. S&P is only down about 67 basis points despite the headlines screaming at you every hour. The market is holding up in a way that's either genuinely impressive or deeply concerning, depending on your read.
Or both.
But the more interesting story the compound was telling wasn't really about the index level. It was about what's happening underneath. The rotation out of megacap growth into value and cyclicals. We're talking 5 standard deviations above average dispersion in S&P returns. Value outperformed growth in Q1 by the widest margin since 2001.
Since 2001. That's not a small asterisk.
Not even close. $2 trillion has flowed out of the mag. 7 into energy names, Exxon, Chevron, pharma, semis, industrials. And one of the hosts made this point that stuck with me. For years, everyone said, when the leaders go down, the rest has to follow. The opposite happened.
The generals retreated, and the infantry kept marching.
Exactly. Now, there's a contrarian read on this from the compound, too, which is that the Q1 rally might be entirely quarter-end rebalancing. 60-40 portfolios mechanically rotating back into equities after their worst quarter since 2022. Which would mean the bottom is a narrative is built on a foundation that disappears in about 3 weeks.
That would be very on brand for 2026.
It would. One more thing from that episode. BlackRock is launching a new NASDAQ 100 ETF called IQQ at about 12 basis points. Direct shot at Invesco's QQQ, which charges 20 basis points and has $376 billion in assets. And here's the part one did not know. The host went and looked up the original 1999 licensing structure, and apparently Invesco built one of the largest ETFs in the world for 26 years and pocketed almost nothing from it because of how the original trust agreement was written.
Wait, really?
They built the third largest ETF in the world and left almost all the economics on the table. Just an extraordinary business school case study in how not to structure a licensing deal.
That's genuinely painful to read about.
Okay. I want to pivot to something darker before we get to tech, because there's a piece of the market picture that I think is genuinely underappreciated. The compound also ran an episode with a guy named Nick Namath, who came in specifically to talk about private credit and life insurance. And Ava, his framing was, private credit is the fuse, the bomb is the life insurance industry.
I heard about this. Walk me through it.
So the U.S. life insurance industry is sitting on about $10 trillion in assets against roughly $9.5 trillion in liabilities. That's about 17 times leverage. For context, Lehman Brothers was at 30 times when it went down, so it's not Lehman, but it's not comfortable either. The $658 billion capital surplus is the only cushion before things start cascading.
And the private credit piece?
The private credit funds are self-marking their NAVs. No independent verification. And Namath made the point that if you look at public BDC equivalents, comparable vehicles that actually trade on exchanges, they're trading at 12 to 25% discounts to their stated NAV, which means the private versions are almost certainly overvalued by a similar margin.
So the marks are flattering.
Flattering is one word. The leverage stacking is the other thing. You've got 7x EBITDA at the borrower level, then 1.5 to 2 times at the fund level, then up to 10 times inside close. That's not 7x leverage. That's 3 layers of leverage sitting on top of each other.
And the insurance companies are the ones holding the bag at the end.
Holding the bag through. And this is the part that really got me. 7 offshore reinsurers based in Bermuda that backstop 680 life insurers. Namath and a forensic accountant he works with believe the claimed $2 trillion in reinsurance backing is actually closer to $1 trillion. And here's the kicker. U.S. regulators are legally blocked from examining Bermuda-domiciled holdings. They literally cannot look at the books.
That's a significant design flaw.
The fuse, as Namath describes it, is redemption acceleration. Blue Owl already seeing about 41% withdrawal requests. When redemptions hit, funds sell their best assets first to meet them. That degrades the remaining NAV, which can trigger credit downgrades, which force capital calls on the insurance companies holding those assets. And then you have a Fed backstop problem, because the insurance balance sheet at $10 trillion actually exceeds the Fed's own balance sheet at around $6
trillion. So the implicit backstop assumption may not be mathematically viable.
That's exactly what Namath is saying. It's not tomorrow's problem, but it's not 10 years away either.
Okay, that's sobering. Let me bring us over to tech and AI because there's actually a lot of interesting stuff here that's worth holding next to those market concerns. So I want to start with something that was on the A16Z podcast this week. Balaji Srinivasan was on, and he had this framework that I keep thinking about. His core argument is that every tool that makes creation cheaper makes verification more expensive.
That's a clean formulation.
Right?
He traces it through history. Printing press made publishing easy and forgery easier. Photography made portraits easy and evidence easy to fake. AI has just compressed that entire cycle into months instead of decades. A resume that used to take hours to falsify convincingly now takes seconds.
Which means the economic value shifts to whoever can verify authenticity.
Exactly. Proctoring, in-person credentialing, chain of trust infrastructure. Balaji's argument is those become growth industries. And he had this line that I thought was really sharp. Crypto is for between tribes, AI is within tribes. The idea being AI supercharges productivity inside a group that already trusts each other, shared codebase, aligned team, but it actually raises walls between groups because the verification problem gets harder across organizational lines.
Which is interesting because it almost inverts the conventional wisdom that AI is this universal productivity layer.
It is universal within a trust boundary. Across trust boundaries, it's actually making things harder. And he extended that into a point about the internet starting to look more like China's digital ecosystem, where building your own stack rather than buying becomes economically rational because you can't verify what you're getting from outside.
Did he talk about physical AI versus digital AI? I caught a clip of that.
He did, and this was one of the more counterintuitive bits. His argument is that physical world AI, robots, self-driving, is actually easier to get right than digital AI because there's only one physical world. Convergent sensor data lets you approach near-perfect reliability. Digital tasks have fuzzier verification. Did the AI actually do the task, or did it just produce output that looks like the task got done?
The physical world has ground truth built in.
Exactly.
And then he had this framework. Humans are the sensor. AI is the actuator. Taste, agency, market sensing, those stay human because AI waits for a prompt. It doesn't wander around noticing things.
I like that. AI doesn't have a nose for news.
Not yet.
Now, there was also stuff on the Compound and Friends about AI company valuations that I want to flag. Anthropic, our parent company's competitor, announced a $30 billion annualized revenue run rate, up from $9 billion at the end of 2025. Enterprise customers spending over $1 million a year doubled to 1,000 customers in under 2 months. OpenAI closed a $122 billion funding round at an $852 billion valuation.
$852 billion.
Amazon put in $50 billion, SoftBank and NVIDIA $35 billion each. And then OpenAI also acquired a tech podcast called TBPN for about $100 million, which got a lot of mockery online.
Which seems weird.
It does seem weird. But the host on the Compound made the point, and I think this is right, it's not a content play. It's Sam Altman buying a controlled media platform ahead of an IPO. The comparison they drew was to Musk buying Twitter. Everyone said that made no sense. It made complete sense as a distribution and narrative control move.
The consensus, this is stupid reaction being exactly wrong.
Which is Elon Twitter Redux, yeah.
Before we move to geopolitics, I want to flag one more AI data point that came out of the Professor G pod this week because it reframes the U.S.-China competition in a way I hadn't fully appreciated. Scott Galloway had a guest, James King, who was breaking down China's tech posture, And the number that jumped out, 67% of Chinese industrial firms have already deployed AI agents in production, versus 34% in the US.
That's double.
Double. And apparently this open source AI agent framework called OpenClaw went viral in China. They're calling it lobster farming in Chinese slang. And token consumption in China went from 100 trillion in December to 140 trillion in March. About a 40% surge in 3 months.
That's extraordinary enterprise adoption speed.
And King's Red was that Chinese platforms, WeChat, DeepSeek, are becoming the dominant AI agent infrastructure in ways that don't show up in the Western narrative about who's winning the AI race.
Okay, let's get to geopolitics because this is where things get genuinely alarming. And Andrew, I want you to weigh in on this too, because some of this has direct market implications.
Go ahead.
So Peter Zeihan dropped something this week on his podcast that I think deserves more attention than it got. He's reporting that Russia provided real-time targeting intelligence to Iran that enabled a successful strike on Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, which is a U.S. military facility. And the strike specifically destroyed an E-3G AWACS aircraft.
Which is the early warning aircraft.
The early warning aircraft. And this is where it gets strategically significant. The U.S. AWACS fleet has shrunk to 14 operational aircraft, with roughly half offline for maintenance at any given time. So you're looking at about 7 globally available. Losing even one is a meaningful degradation of U.S. early warning capability in theater.
And there's no sea-based equivalent for this mission.
Zeihan makes that point explicitly. Unlike some sensor systems, you can't just put this on a ship and get the same coverage. The loss is real. But the bigger story he's telling is that Russia is now actively feeding tactical targeting data to Iran on American military assets. That is a qualitative escalation.
And his read is that the current administration isn't treating it seriously.
That's his explicit point. Quote, "There isn't any number of ways where that's not a very, very negative development, and we have yet to see it being treated seriously by this administration at all."
The framing that stuck with me from that episode is that Iran might be the weapon and Russia is the shooter.
That's exactly right. Iran is the delivery mechanism. The strategic actor is Moscow.
The Economist podcast this week had a lot of good texture on the actual shape of the conflict, which I think is worth layering in here. Their Middle East correspondent Greg Carl had this observation that the two sides are effectively fighting parallel wars, the U.S. and Israel targeting Iran's industrial and military infrastructure, Iran going after Gulf energy assets, and both sides can credibly claim to be winning their own war while simultaneously losing the other one.
Which is a recipe for a conflict that has no obvious termination point.
Right. And on the Iran economic side, their largest steel mills are offline for at least a year. Those normally generate about $7 billion a year in export revenue. Inflation was already near 50% pre-war. The economy is under real structural pressure.
But not pressure that translates quickly into political capitulation. That's the problem.
Never does. Now, Trump made that threat about destroying Iran's entire power grid, every power plant burning, never to be used again by 12 o'clock, and The Economist was pretty direct that this would likely constitute a war crime under international law and could trigger Iranian retaliation against Gulf desalination infrastructure.
And Gulf cities without water desalination are not viable on any short time horizon.
The reputational damage to Gulf states as investment destinations is already lasting, regardless of how the conflict resolves.
Now I want to bring back the China angle because James King's analysis on Professor G connected directly to this. China and Pakistan unveiled a 5-point peace plan for Iran, ceasefire, peace talks, protecting civilian infrastructure, reopening the Strait of Hormuz, comprehensive peace framework, backed by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
Which sounds impressive until you ask who enforces it.
Which is exactly King's point. He said, and I think this is the crux, the idea of China as a genuine security guarantor is a non-starter. China doesn't want to be the cop. They want to be the diplomat who gets credit for the ceasefire without having to bleed for it.
Meanwhile, Chinese AI firms are publicly posting real-time satellite imagery of U.S. military movements in the Gulf.
Right. This Shanghai company called Quaimu Vision is using open-source intelligence to publish live tracking of U.S. military assets. Which is legal, it's open source data, but the implication that Iran can access it is not subtle.
And all of this is happening 1 week before a planned Trump-Xi summit tentatively scheduled for mid-May, which China is also undermining by launching trade investigations into U.S. practices at the same time. While the FBI is calling a China-linked hack of a U.S. surveillance system a major cyber incident.
It's almost elegant in its cynicism. Shake with one hand, hack with the other.
King's read on this was interesting. He left China, he said, both amazed by the speed of China's tech advance and deeply concerned that the backlash may be coming. And he flagged that youth unemployment from AI displacement could exceed 20% in China this year, which might force a government crackdown on AI adoption similar to the 2021 tech crackdown.
Which would be a wild reversal from the current let-it-rip posture.
Wild, but not without precedent. Beijing has done it before.
One more piece I want to flag from The Economist before we get to what we're watching, the Indian IT story. 3 years after ChatGPT, Infosys and TCS are showing basically no revenue disruption. Headcount is still growing. The AI adoption is bottlenecked by legacy systems and regulatory complexity.
The dog that didn't bark.
But there's a structural shift happening that's more interesting. Multinationals are moving core tech functions in-house to global capability centers in India rather than outsourcing to Infosys and TCS. So Indian engineers may end up managing AI tools inside big companies rather than being replaced by them. The disruption is to the outsourcing model, not to Indian engineering talent.
Which is a more nuanced story than AI kills Indian IT.
Much more nuanced. Okay, what are we watching today?
A few things. I'm watching private credit redemption data very closely after that Namath episode. Blue Owl's 41% withdrawal figure is the canary. If we start seeing more funds report elevated redemption requests this week, that's a signal worth paying attention to.
I'm watching any response or non-response from Washington on the Russian targeting intelligence story. Zihin's point that this isn't being taken seriously is either wrong, in which case there's a response coming, or it's right, in which case the silence is itself news.
I'm also watching the Strait of Hormuz. Josh Brown had this line on the compound that stuck with me. The hostage is not a person. It's the Strait of Hormuz. China gets about 50% of its seaborne oil through there. Their strategic reserves by them maybe 3 or 4 months. At some point, Beijing has to make a move to secure bilateral oil access with Iran, and that move reshapes the whole regional picture.
And on the tech side, I'm watching whether OpenAI's TBPN acquisition gets a second look now that the initial mockery has settled. If the Musk Twitter analogy holds, in 6 months we'll be talking about it differently.
Fair enough.
All right, that's Morning Signal for Monday, April 7th. A lot moving out there. Stay sharp, and we'll be back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening. Go get your coffee.